Welcome to the Art Talk podcast, where I discuss the stories that help us accomplish to be better artists as well as better art entrepreneurs. I am Karin Merks, your host, and I'm artist, art entrepreneur, and art coach or teacher. This is episode 57 of Art Talk, and today I have a very special guest of whom I'm super excited she accepted my invitation. Let me introduce you to Kristen Dicatoli. Kristen Dicatoli holds a BA in chemistry, an MA in art conservation from the Winter University of Delaware program in art conservation, specializing in easel paintings. She has a PhD in preservation studies from the University of Delaware. She has held internships and contracts positions at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, my museum, the G. Paul Getty Museum, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and the Smithsonian American Art Museum. She has maintained a private practice since 2008 and continues to be involved with teaching art conservation and technical art history at the graduate-undergraduate level. Kristen has also been involved in a number of web-based initiatives, including the CREST Technical Art History website and MITRA, the Materials, Information and Technical Resources for Artists. Welcome, Kristen. I'm so very happy to have you as my guest.
It's my pleasure.
So what attracted you to become a conservationist, a restoration specialist of art?
Right. So this is a question that conservators get most often. And I should say right from the start, I know the terminology is confusing sometimes. From the U.S. to Europe, you'll encounter restorer, you'll encounter conservator. So, just for clarification, we tend to identify ourselves at the professional level in the U.S., mm-hmm. as conservators. So that's the term I'm going to be using, but just understand that depending on what country you're in, that term can change. So I became interested in conservation. Everybody has a different story and a different path. No one really follows the same path to this very strange, small field. But it's a very special, unique field. So I went to a liberal arts college, which was a very good fit for me. And so much so that when I knew I was always going to pursue a science degree, but I was also at a liberal arts school, you know, in the U.S., you're generally encouraged to take courses that are outside of what you're majoring in. So I had a very good advisor who saw that I'm interested in art and art history and recommended that I take a semester abroad and only focusing on those things. So I did that. And I lived in London and Florence for my semester abroad. And I fell in love with art and art history there. And I encountered the concept of art conservation over there peripherally. And then I came back and we did some more research and he found out, he helped me do research. This is in the beginning days of the internet when it was starting to be useful. And mm-hmm. so we identified that there were graduate programs in the U.S. So I looked into getting into the schools here in the U.S. and realized that I was shy, definitely a few courses, and the amount of hours it takes to get into the schools here is exorbitant. So you need a certain number of hours to get in, mm-hmm. To apply. So it's a sort of a catch-22 situation. And students are still facing this today. It's a huge challenge. So you have to build up a number of what we call pre-program hours before you even bother applying. So I recognized that I had 0 hours, but I needed a few more art history classes. The schools, generally you basically need a triple major to apply. You need to go through science, at least through organic chemistry. You need to have a certain number of art history and studio art courses. And you also need, so the three, so studio art, art history, science, but you also need Like I said, that a big chunk of that is the hours. It could be volunteering at your local museum, helping with rehousing projects, survey work, or working, volunteering, interning alongside a practicing conservator, developing your hand skills if you're lucky to get such an opportunity. Times have changed drastically. I called up a bunch of museums that were in the Midwest where my undergraduate college was based, and nobody knew what to do with me or frankly wanted me because I was a science major. And they said, well, we don't know if we can use you. You majored in science. Now it's very different. They'll scoop you up with a science major. But that shift was still happening at that point in time of recognizing the important role that science plays in our field. And now it's very much recognized. So I decided to take out loans and go to Italy again, because there was a program there, which is no longer in existence. It unfortunately, I think was terminated more or less as a result of COVID recently. But it was the Studio Art Centers International Program in Florence, and they offered a year-long post-baccalaureate program. And I applied, got in, like I said, took out loans to go there, but it paid off tremendously in the end for me in the long term, because I was able to rack up hours there that counted towards getting into the schools back at home in the U.S. Or frankly, I didn't know if I was going to go back to the U.S. or not at that point. I was open to looking at other schools in Europe as well. And then ultimately I ended up being hired by one of the professors there, who was a fourth generation art restorer, Italian man. He was wonderful. He didn't speak any English. So that was a great experience though, because I was given hands-on opportunity to work in a very well-established Florentine art restoration studio immediately. Wow. So there was no room for, and it was a fast pace because it was in the private sector. So we were, and he hired two or three of us, and we each had a job. So my job was retouching or in painting. So that was my job right out of the gate. And I fell in love with that, and that really sitting down at the easel for the first time and retouching a painting, I knew I was pretty much hooked from then on. And that's what I needed to do with my life.
Oh my God. I can imagine. I can only look at those pieces and study the brush, but you can touch it. Wow.
Yeah. it's a pretty unique experience.
That must be. Absolutely. I mean, I can imagine the thrill. And so with all this, the education you need, also science, and you say that has become way more important, which I can imagine, and we come to a part of that later also. But also technical art history, and how is it with your artistic being? What do you need that? Do you need to have a kind of artistic talent when you... restore those, when you go with your pencil into the artwork of of
a
master?
A very, very good question. And it's one that is very close to my heart, literally, because I'm married to a paintings conservator as well. We met in the graduate program at University of Delaware, and he came to this field in a different path. He obtained a BFA at the Art Institute of Chicago. So he was a painter before he entered the field. So before I met my husband, I found myself, so I entered I didn't have a ton of studio art experience. I had enough to apply to get into the program, but not a ton, especially with painting. I'd only ever painted with acrylic paints a few times before. Most of my studio art portfolio, because you do have to submit a portfolio of studio art work, and they want to see a wide breadth of, so I had a sculpture, several etchings that I had done in a printmaking class in my undergraduate time. And then I love pastels and charcoal. drawings mostly. Mm-hmm. So that was the main strength of my portfolio, but not painting. But I always loved paintings. Every time I was in a city or traveling, I would just go to the museums and couldn't stay away from the paintings. Couldn't. So when I got in, I found myself in all of a sudden, after a year of work at the University of Delaware, in the middle of Los Angeles, at one of the most prestigious institutions, the Getty, in their conservation studio. And I was recruited specifically for my retouching skills. But many hours retouching it's very repetitive, and you spend a long time reflecting and thinking about things at the easel because our job is very slow and methodical. So I began reflecting on realizing that I had still some gaps in terms of my education. And if I was going to be fixing paintings, easel paintings my entire life, I realized that I needed to know more about the actual craft of making a painting from start to finish. Mm-hmm. So I realized this was not something that I had done. It's actually not a requirement for any of the schools. It's a nice thing if you are able to have that opportunity as a pre-program student to do that. Not very many students do, because my husband is one of them, the people that are out there that have that knowledge and that artistic ability to teach that skill are few and far between. It's hard to find them. So I phoned my mentor, instructor, Dr. Joyce Hill Stoner at the University of Delaware. And I said, I need to make a painting from scratch. I want to use all the original pigments. I want to plane my own panel. I want to make my own gesso. I want to make my just from start to finish. So I spent a year as an elective course doing that in addition to my other studies for my that was during my second year. So that was very eye-opening. And that was my first foray and interest. That's where my interest began in technical art history, because you really see how much you don't know until you work with these materials, which are tricky, and all of the variables that go into, literally from start to finish, from the ground up, as we say. That was a big, that's really where my interest in technical art history began. And I've done I've done projects ever since that moment throughout my career to help better inform myself, but sometimes hopefully the field as well, because my husband and I try to publish, or with other colleagues, we'll try to publish our findings and what we discover along the way when we do these technical studies.
It's so interesting. And I can imagine, I know from my own studies, and it takes, it takes years to learn a skill, a proper skill, like sight size, like model, portrait, etc. Skill, it's a true skill. But I also know that when you paint on canvas, how Rembrandt did this, the gesso, the Venetian red, the gray, or the ochre yellow as a second imprimatura, and it's so important to know that. It's so important to know that you start with thin and then go to thicker layers.
Yes, absolutely.
Otherwise it gets a mess. Must have been thrilling to do that. It adds to what you do when you approach a painting like that. It's what I can imagine.
Yes, it does. So if you know how a painting is constructed, or how an artist and his or her workshop tends to create paintings, and that can change over the course of one's career as well, right? You have early Rembrandt, looks very different from late Rembrandt. So knowing that, and then if somebody brings you a damaged painting that's attributed to that artist, then you have a lot more knowledge on your side, and you can sort of perceive, okay, I think I know how this painting was meant to appear. Mm-hmm. And you do your best, because, but it's invaluable to go to as many museums as possible and collections and look and just look and look and look, but also read the literature and stay abreast of current knowledge and current findings. Mm-hmm. And that those two things together are very useful when we are confronted with difficult and challenging projects at the easel, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I get to that in a question. And you work on old masters. A lot of the more modern art have become now already old masters. So yeah,
I actually work on everything now. And
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, I do. And it's because the private sector has demanded it. Though I'm based in the smallest state, one of the smallest states in our country, in Delaware, there are 5 to 6 art storage depots here, all owned by different companies. And Delaware happens to be the Geneva, Switzerland of the US for tax reasons. There are an incredible number of amazing artworks being stored here. I should say that most of the art depots that I work at, they're all running out of room and they're starting to expand because so much art is coming here. So I get more calls these days with problems to do with modern contemporary, and we can get into that later. But yes, traditionally my training has been on old master paintings spanning, from 1300 to 1900. However, my husband and I have done a lot of technical studies on turn of the century artists as well. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how much knowing how to read the literature and to research, fugitive pigments and be aware of just materials in general, that it helps to inform me every day when I'm looking at modern contemporary pieces, because I can identify problems right away just with that foundational knowledge.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. I had a whole discussion with my framer, who also, for his clients, they come in and they have a painting and it just comes off. Mm-hmm. And he says often they use a wall primer to prime the canvas. Yeah. That's not for, I said, how can you do that? So those people have no former training.
Right.
You see now that they use acrylic and oil and ink all together. And I have like, okay. Mm-hmm. So I heard also a museum curator, and it was in the Netherlands when I still lived there, once saying that it would be great if artists knew their materials and create work that can be preserved. Mm-hmm. So you restore paintings, which simultaneously make them conserved for the future, hopefully. How important is it for painters now to make work that in time can be restored? And have you seen modern art that was beyond restoration?
Right. All good questions. So my husband and I have dedicated a good number of years to doing collaborative endeavors with artists, living artists, and also working with art materials companies like Gamblin and Golden. Kramer, you might recognize that from in Europe. There's a number of these companies, Natural Pigments, which is based in California. There are a number of companies out there that recognize that this kind of knowledge is lacking in the art community at large. It's not being taught in schools anymore. Sometimes, occasionally, at ateliers, it might be. But it really depends on who the instructors are. And even then, these people are retiring. And this is not knowledge that's being transferred to the new, younger generations.
Yeah.
Or even not so young generations anymore.
Yeah.
So So you mentioned one of our web projects, Mitra. So MITRA.
Yeah.
It's a free forum that is hosted by the University of Delaware that anybody can join. And you can post technical questions on there as an artist regarding, we get anything from varnish artists that are struggling with varnishing to layering. Can I mix this material with that material? How should I display my painting? How should I pack it and transport it? And we have a lot of informational packets that you can download for free. And this is not just coming from, this information is not just coming from myself and my husband. It's there are a number of forum moderators on there who represent, they have different expertise. So someone from, and then we try to also have people that can speak for each of the companies. So there'll be a golden rep on there who is familiar with golden products. If somebody comes in and says, I'm using this varnish from golden and I'm not sure if it's working correctly. So we try to do that. So we recognize the importance of having a forum like that. And then we've tried to give as many talks as we can, but it's hard to reach. I would say that in general, this knowledge is lacking. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I would say there's pros and cons, I think, to giving this kind of information to, if you think of a young, impressionable, emerging artist who's trying to absorb as much as possible at the beginning of their career, you don't want to scare them too much. And it's okay. I think a certain level of experimentation is warranted and necessary for them to find their own paths and the materials they like and the method they like to use. But I think it's important to plant a little seed, just a little one early on, so they have this dialogue in the back of their mind. Okay, I've decided that I really like this effect in these materials. What's the best way forward for me to use all of those things and then produce artwork that's not going to fall apart in the next 6 months? You know, that's really what we're talking about sometimes.
Now 6 months was a bit quick, but I can imagine.
We've seen it all. So the second part of your question, have I seen artworks that are basically not salvageable? Yeah. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. A really good example comes to mind where this painting must have been about anywhere between 5 to 10 years old. It's a contemporary piece. The artist is still living. The problem with this painting, it was very large, probably 8 foot tall, 12 foot wide. And this artist is primarily known for their use of fluorescent colors. Now, these fluorescent pigments are notorious for fading. They fade if you look at them hard enough, some of the colors, particularly the reds, the pinks, they will just fade to like a neutral beige color, or like a faint salmon.
And
they will fade in the dark. Some of them will even fade in low lighting situations. They're just not stable. They're meant to be ephemeral, bright, punchy right then and there, used for, I don't know, in black light settings. I don't know, but they're not, the way that these dyes are made, they are just prone to being very fugitive. This artwork, you know, it got published, it was made and published in a catalog or a gallery's opening. And this particular, but you know, a lot of her paintings have sold. She's done quite well, but this one, it sat in storage for a bit. And when the gallery pulled it, it was a ghost of itself. So they called the artist to see if she would repaint it. She said no, because it's theirs now. They own it. Mm-hmm. It's out of her hands. Mm-hmm. So then they called me and asked me to repaint it. And I said, absolutely not. they didn't know. They asked if this can be saved. And I said, no. And the problem is you're stuck with a painting that is a far cry from how it appears in the published catalog. When it first got put on the wall, it's a ghost of itself. So what do you do? I don't have an answer for that. So there are things like that that we can convey to, you know, young artists or artists in general.
It should be in the education, you know. I teach it. When I have someone who wants to learn how to paint with oil, I teach it. Because if you don't teach it, they end up very frustrated anyway.
Yeah.
And they can't get the colors out. They have no clue how to set it up. You see straight through the canvas because they didn't use any gesso under it, no underpainting, imprimatura. And even then, canvas can still have something. But I think it's something that you need to learn. And even I do it constantly because the paints change. I mean, more paints nowadays are opaque. Mm-hmm. How do you work with that? Because it or not opaque, they're transparent. Mm-hmm. And only when you really start to grind your own painting, your own paint, mm-hmm. you can make opaque paints. But it is a challenge. It is definitely a challenge.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, student grade paints that you buy at the store, I mean, they're going to be full, quite frankly, you get what you pay for, you know, of junk, of fugitive pigments, dyes instead of the actual. And this is an ongoing discussion and problem within industry, you know, how much there are on certain tubes, rating systems, and we have a guide on Mitra to, you know, walk people through how to read that. But a lot of people just buy the tube for the color and they don't bother reading on the label. But it's important sometimes. Having some sort of accountability to, you know, industry standards for making sure you label what's in there appropriately. They're not going to label everything, of course, because some of these mixtures are proprietary. But at least at the very bare minimum, what pigments are in there, the primary binder. And some of them don't always do that. Good companies will list that information, but it's a challenge. It is.
Yeah. But when you use paints like Old Holland, for instance, that's pure pigment and linseed oil.
Old Holland is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Comes from Holland.
Yeah.
But so what kind of decisions do you need to make when you get a painting? And you see former restorations. Do you need to do more research to see what the painter originally did and bring the original painting back? Or is there also some kind of respect for the way of thinking at that time of restoration as part of these decisions? And I imagine that your science comes in here too.
Yes. So it's definitely changes case by case situation. If you have a painting that is very well documented before it has been damaged or subjected to an expert cleaning, shall we say, or restoration, then that's a blessing. I mean, we don't get that very much, but it does happen. And so you at least have documentation in the form of photos, even archival photos. Maybe the damage is quite small and you're able to fix the area and you have an idea of the layering process and so on. I should say that we don't tend to use, sometimes we do, but there's this idea that we use the original materials that the artist used during our process. And that is not always true. In fact, I'd say most of the time it's not true because we want our materials to be chemically different and distinguishable from the original. So we do have paints that are specially made for conservation that we use. So no fugitive pigments. I know that the pigments I'm using are going to not change, but also the binder. So we don't use oil paints when we restore oil paintings. That's a big no-no. And we don't use, that's because oil. I should say 80%, 70% of the time I'm restoring an old master painting, I have to remove maybe retouching that was put on in the 1920s, 30s, and it's oil paint. So I have to remove some, and it's discolored or darkened. Mm-hmm. So oil paint does not age. If you put on oil paint from the 20s and 30s onto an old master painting from 1600, 1700, that fresh oil paint that was put on in the 30s and 40s will shift in color and tone over time, and it will discolor. And you'll be able to see that from a mile away. So we, in, you know, several years down the road. So we've learned from that as a craft, as a, our field evolved out of a craft. We were, you know, craft-based profession, and now we are considered to be a formal profession. So we've learned that, learned from that mistake. So our paints, they tend to be acrylic-based, or an aldehyde resin. They're different synthetic resins that are very reversible, meaning I will spend 5 months retouching a painting sometimes, and somebody could come in and take all of my retouching off with just one solvent in 30 minutes. Wow. So that's how reversible they are. So the idea is all the materials, including film materials that we add, are chemically most of the time different from the original. So you can distinguish our work from the original, if you were to use UV light or chemical tests, that there's that. So the pit in terms of pigments, sometimes I may use bone black or, you know, earth colors that the original artist used, but sometimes I might not. So Red Lake is a good example, because we know that I can't use Red Lake pigments that the original artist used because they will fade. I know that if I were to use genuine Black Lake or Yellow Lakes in my conservation paints, it will fade, and you will be able to see it will become distracting over time, and then it will get pulled off the wall, and it'll have to be retouched again. So the idea is you want your work to hold its own for as long as possible, so the painting doesn't have to be messed with quite as frequently throughout its lifetime. The pigments that we use different pigments that are more stable for that color, let's say. So we don't always use, and I don't use lead white to retouch. So we'll use, I tend to use titanium white.
Titanium,
And so, which is challenging because titanium white is not, it's a different hue than that warm color that lead white imparts, but there are things you can add to it that will help. So we do have certain pigments that we tend to stay away from, and that are not always chemically the same as the original. Yeah.
That's quite a challenge, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So you have to really look per project, per painting, and on that base from the research you do, what to use, how to use it, etc.
Yes. Yeah. And the same goes with varnishing. I will not. Yeah. So some people still use Damar varnish. Some restorers do. Or even mastic, which is fine. They are beautiful varnishes. They go on; they're irreplaceable in terms of getting that wonderful old master satin glossy finish. However, we know they yellow. That's usually what I'm taking off most of the time on paintings. Yeah. It's these old yellowed mastic and Damar varnishes. So we have at our disposal today many synthetic varnishes that have undergone extensive testing to make sure they don't turn turbid or go gray or yellow discolor, and that they remain reversible over time. And so again, the varnishes that we use they don't tend to be. So increasingly more as we go on as a field, we tend to use these synthetic varnishes.